Hello, this is The Wire. My name is Stephen Regal from 4EB in Brisbane. Today, science reveals mystery human teeth in Southeast Asia date back more than 60,000 years.
This is a really good example of, you know, modern archaeological techniques applied to a long-standing problem. We had 120 years of this evidence being around, there were suggestions that it was modern humans, there were suggestions that it was old, and yet it has never even been considered in the models of human dispersal.
And we look again at the government's proposed higher education reforms.
At some point, the cost of education will rise to an amount where students will be put off from enrolling in education. The second thing that might happen, which is even more worrying, is that the cost might rise to such a degree that it doesn't put students off, but they find when they graduate that the debt that they have is too great for them to bear.
All that and more, current affairs coming up soon. Thanks for tuning in. We're with you for the next half hour. Well, at the urging of industry figures, the federal government will amend the Fair Work Act to make it harder for two large unions to join together. The Australian reports that 30 executives from the oil, mining and gas industries met cabinet ministers to urge them to stop the merger of the Construction, Mining, Forestry and Energy Union and the Maritime Union of Australia. Employment Minister Michaela Cash says the merger presents a major threat to Australia's productivity and economic prosperity. But Professor David Peets from Griffith University's Centre for Work, Organisation and Wellbeing says the government's fears are misplaced.
The MUA's main interest isn't really with the construction division of the CFMEU, it's with the mine workers. Now, the CFMEU is itself a merger of three unions that dates back to the 1990s, which were the construction workers, the mine workers and the forestry workers. Now, the construction workers are by far the biggest part of that, and they're the people who get into all the press. But the close links that have existed really for quite a long time between the MUA has had have actually been with the mining and energy people, and that's a much smaller part. There's like maybe 20,000 or so, I'm not sure of the numbers really, but something of that order of magnitude people in the mining and energy division. So in a sense, they're getting very agitated about something that isn't quite real, because they're very worried that it's these construction union people that are going to be linking up with the MUA, but really the much closer links are with the mining people. And up until fairly recently, like when the CFMEU was created, they were really three separate unions operating in their own domains. And it's only in the last few years that there's been any sort of major coherence in the action between those unions anyway. It's partly fear of something that may not be realised anyway, and it's also just a general fear about union amalgamations. And the Conservative parties in Australia don't particularly like union amalgamations because they fear that will lead to more powerful unions. Indeed, way back in 1972, the then Liberal government of Billy McMahon passed laws trying to make it hard for the AMWU, what was then called the Amalgamated Metalworkers Union, to be created by putting various roadblocks in the way. And you know, those unions have merged anyway because the members want them. And that's presumably what you would expect people would be entitled to do, that if the members want to create a larger organisation, they should be entitled to create a larger organisation. And the hearings that are presently in front of the Fair Work Commission are mainly about that, about whether they should be able to proceed to ballot, to ask the members formally whether they want to merge.
One of the things the government has said, you would have seen in the story in The Australian, is that there's no require for mergers to be in members' interests, whatever that means, but it has been mentioned in numerous occasions that the MUA has already balloted their members and they've voted for it. So hasn't there already been a sort of show of support? And like you were saying, the Fair Work Commission is considering whether there should be further ballots.
Yeah, that's right. And yes, it's a bit odd to be saying this isn't in members' interests when the members of each of the unions have so far internally supported the merger process. So what the Commission's now going to do is to have a formal ballot, but of course the unions have had their own internal processes to decide whether the members support them. They're not going to go to a ballot with the Commission in the expectation that they'd lose. They'd test the membership ideas in the first place.
Hmm. There was a little bit of criticism from within the MUA that has been documented in news reports earlier in the year, with some members claiming that with union amalgamations in the 90s, that unions became, I suppose, more corporatized or less militant, that members lose their individual identity and sense of purpose when those sorts of things happen. Do you think there's any sort of danger in anything like that happening?
Well, I think the mergers that took place in the 1990s, overall, they, you know, in some cases, the unions were better off as a result of having done it because they were able to pool resources and, in doing so, put more emphasis on the workplace. In some cases, they were probably worse off because they became more remote. It really depended upon what the particular unions did. Now, the MUA and the CFMEU, particularly the Mining and Energy Division, which is the one that's worked most closely with the MUA, but also really the Construction and General Division, they're fairly focused on the members. I think that if you're looking at unions that were going to become more remote from their membership, I don't really think these two would fall into that category.
Professor David Peets from Griffith University ending that story. A major expedition has confirmed modern humans were living in Southeast Asia 20,000 years earlier than past evidence suggested. An international team led by Dr. Kira Westaway from Macquarie University found and dated the site where ancient human teeth were discovered 120 years ago by a famed Dutch scientist. The location of the cave, deep in the Sumatran jungle, was only known through a sketch in Eugene Dubois' notebook, and according to Dr. Westaway, it took quite a bit of searching to find.
We obviously wanted to find the site again, because then we could get the sedimentary context of where the fossils and the teeth were actually found. And once we find those sediments, then we can actually, you know, do the dating. Now, to confirm that we were in the right location, we actually had a copy of Dubois' original field notebook. So we had a little photocopy of it, and we actually were looking around for this site, Leader Aja. And the problem was is that all the locals had a different idea of which cave was Leader Aja. Now, obviously, Dubois called it Leader Aja because that's what the locals were calling it at the time. But 120 years later, the locals don't have that connection in understanding of the names of the caves. So it was actually very difficult to find. We pretty much went around most of the caves that they said were Leader Aja. And then they were taking us up to a much higher cave, higher up. And they said, I just don't think it's right. I think the altitude is too high. And they said, oh, there's a lower one halfway down. Do you want to have a look at that one? So I was like, yeah, I'll give anything a try at this point. And we went, and as I walked in to the front entrance, I realized that this was the right cave because it matched exactly Dubois' original map plan of the cave. And then when we actually got there, we walked to the back. There were sediments preserved in the back chamber of the cave. And we started to pick around in some of the what we call breccia units, almost a rock deposit that you find within caves. And we started to pick around, and we found pretty much every single fauna that Dubois had listed for that site. So we were very, very certain that this is exactly the site that Dubois had dug.
Dr. Westaway says the evidence they have collected helps fill in a missing link between finds in Australia and other parts of the world.
This is a really good example of, you know, modern archaeological techniques applied to a long-standing problem. We had 120 years of this evidence being around, there were suggestions that it was modern humans, there were suggestions that it was old, and yet it has never even been considered in the models of human dispersal. this cave has been shrouded in doubt since it was first excavated. We've always known the evidence, but no one's really believed it. And now, hopefully, with this new chronology and 100% confirmation that they are anatomically modern human teeth, then we can actually, hopefully, confidently say that modern humans were in Southeast Asia 20,000 years earlier. And that's really addressed the sort of missing link in Southeast Asia, as it were. You know, now we can fully make up the chain from, you know, an early exit from Africa down through Southeast Asia and then an early entry into Australia. So it kind of puts that final chink in that chain of human dispersal.
The discovery comes as recent remains dug out of Kakadu in the Northern Territory show human occupation in the area goes back 65,000 years. As in Kakadu, sediment from the cave Lida Arja was analysed to provide a date for the teeth. The remains themselves are housed in the Naturalist Biodiversity Centre in Leiden, Netherlands.
When we're doing the dating, obviously we can't date the actual human teeth themselves. Leiden Museum would not allow us to do that. But we were able to date mammalian teeth from that excavation. So we dated some of the teeth that we found, orangutan and gibbon teeth, but we also dated some of the teeth that Dubois had found as well, so orangutan teeth from Dubois. And they were of very similar composition, looked very, very similar, and the ages came out very similar as well. So we're really confident that the deposit that we're looking at right now is the same deposit that Dubois originally found in the cave.
While the rediscovery of the cave and the dating of the site has answered some questions, others remain. Some researchers are puzzled by the appearance of human remains in West Sumatra, far from the coast, so long ago.
Well, we always think that the early modern humans would have been more coastal dwellers, mainly because it's much easier to live on the coastlines. There's a lot more resources and very easy to find food. Obviously, the rainforest is very bountiful, but the problem with the rainforest is that when you're actually on the floor of the rainforest, most of the food sources are up in the canopies. So it does actually take more sophisticated hunting techniques and sort of more innovative practices to actually be able to survive. Now, some people sort of say, oh, well, you know, finding two teeth doesn't mean that they were living and surviving in the rainforest. That's true. But for them to actually be found there, they must have actually got there. So they've walked all the way through. And if you look at the time, the rainforest corridor was very, very extensive. So we're not talking a little bit of rainforest. We're talking vast expanses of rainforest. It was such a huge amount of rainforest that they would have had to been there for a long time to actually been found in that location. So they may not have adapted, you know, and learned how to live there, but even passing through, they would have had to still have the skills to find food.
Dr. Kira Westaway from Macquarie University ending that story. Higher education expert Dr. Tim Pittman joins us to explain what the government's changes to higher education could mean for students and universities across the country. Danielle Daly has this story.
The Senate Committee on Higher Education reviewed the government's proposals to the sector this week, recommending that the new proposals to rein in spending, increase fees and lower the repayment threshold be passed. Curtin University's Dr. Tim Pittman says these changes could have significant impacts on students and universities.
With the research you've conducted into the reformed changes into university funding, what do you think the impact will be on students?
Well, if the reforms are passed, it's quite clear that the cost to students will rise, the amount of money going to universities to deliver their teaching will drop, and students will be required to pay back the money earlier. Labor, when they oppose these reforms, they've used the phrase and they've pointed out that students are going to have to pay more for less sooner. In return, the government says that they feel that these requests, these changes are proportionate. They'll balance the government's need to recover money that they spend in higher education without stopping or compromising the quality of education or stopping students from entering.
If the price of degrees goes up, do you believe that it will encourage people not to apply to go to university?
This is the great unknown. The history to date for the last 25 years has been no. The system that Australia has devised, where students are given an income contingent loan, meaning the government covers the cost of their portion of the education and they don't have to pay it back until they start earning a certain amount of money. The history for the last 25 years has shown that it has not stopped students from accessing higher education. And what the government is hoping is that the latest round of proposed raises won't change anything. Over the last 25 years, at various times, various governments have raised the cost of education to students, and to date that hasn't stopped them from enrolling. But this isn't an infinite thing. At some point, the cost of education will rise to an amount where students will be put off from enrolling in education. The second thing that might happen, which is even more worrying, is that the cost might rise to such a degree that it doesn't put students off, but they find when they graduate that the debt that they have is too great for them to bear. The problem with this, for both for government and students, is we won't know if we've hit that tipping point until we hit that tipping point, so to speak. It's only when students stop enrolling that you realise that you've raised it too much, or it's only when students suddenly realise that they're not getting the benefits of their education for the cost that they put into it, that it's too late.
And how could this impact particularly New Zealand and permanent residents who will now be eligible to receive HECS help funding, but they won't be entitled to Commonwealth support or place?
New Zealanders and permanent residents are certainly being singled out. Now, again, this is kind of like the government is taking away with one hand and giving with another. So under the current system, New Zealanders and permanent residents have access to the subsidised course costs. In other words, they pay the same amount as Australian students. However, as a permanent resident and New Zealanders, they have to pay up front. They can't defer it with a loan and pay it back through work tax. The government's proposing to reverse that. So under the new changes, they'll say, no, you can't get the subsidised rate. You have to pay the full fees, which can be 2 to 3 times greater than they're currently paying. But in return, the government says you will be able to access the same loan scheme as the Australians. So again, it depends on which side of the fence you're sitting. The government says, yes, even though the cost of their education is going up, we're actually giving them a very, very attractive loan scheme, just like the Australian students, to get it. But on the other side, obviously those people are concerned are saying the cost of their education as permanent residents and New Zealanders is going to go up potentially 3 times, potentially triple. In the submissions when the government put out these reforms, those have probably been the greatest number of submissions and the most emotional submissions have come from permanent residents and New Zealanders who quite clearly are worried about these changes and how it will affect them.
Is education enough of a factor that could impact people immigrating from New Zealand?
That's really hard to tell. Obviously, when these things first come out and people realise how that affects them, it can be a very emotional, and people will understandably say, look, this changes things. I may have to leave the country to do an education. And certainly for some, that will be the case. Whether that will happen in any great number, it's too early to tell. And also, we've never done this before, so we really don't know what the effect is going to be. Certainly, people are signalling in their submissions and in their statements when they heard about these reforms. A lot of them are signalling that they are that they would be willing or might have no choice but to do that. Whether they actually do that, we'll have to wait and see.
Also in the university reforms is a cut in funding to universities themselves. How would that impact the research universities do?
It will affect all universities because the cut the government proposes is an efficiency dividend. Now, that's going to affect all universities and they are very worried about that. Research universities, the fact in Australia is research is largely subsidised by teaching. In other words, a certain amount of money that comes in through teaching revenue goes towards research. So these cuts are going to impact all universities, but the universities that are doing the research that has been gone in the universities will also be affected in that way too. But for the purposes of the current conversation and what the government's trying to do here, I think the greater concern is the effect that it would have on teaching.
Well, osteoporosis is not something most young people think about, but medical researchers have discovered that ensuring good bone health needs to start in your teens. Daniel Daly has more.
New research from the University of South Australia indicates that women are more at risk of developing osteoporosis in old age, but getting a good supply of vitamin D over the course of one's life can help prevent the illness. Professor Howard Morris explains how these nutrients protect our bones and the impact menopausal estrogen loss has on women's bone health.
We've been very interested in the nutritional strategies for the prevention of osteoporosis for many years, and we've been investigating particularly the role of dietary calcium intake and vitamin D status throughout life, but particularly amongst the ageing, and the ability of a good nutrition to reduce the risk of fractures, particularly in the elderly years. And what we've been finding is that it is the combination of vitamin D and calcium, and adequate vitamin D nutrition and adequate calcium nutrition, that protects the bone, it reduces the risk of fracture.
On your article in The Conversation, it indicated that this is a problem that can be prevented over the course of time by consuming the right amount of calcium and vitamin D in particular to prevent bone deterioration.
There are a number of factors involved as we pass through our life cycle. So particularly in the young, that as we grow, adequate nutrition, as you mentioned, particularly with regard to calcium and vitamin D and exercise, an adequate nutrition increases the strength of our bone for adulthood. And that strength consists of more mineral in the bones and also a better quality of bone. We found that the vitamin D status is associated with an improved quality of bone. But even in this elderly age, adequate nutrition can assist in improving bone quality and therefore bone strength.
You mentioned that menopause and pregnancy were key factors in women particularly leading to bone deterioration.
With pregnancy, there is a demand on the mother's body's calcium complement, which is largely 99% of it is in bone. There is a demand for the growth of the baby's skeleton, and therefore that calcium comes from the mother's skeleton and goes into the baby's skeleton. However, once the mother has given birth to the baby and ceased lactation, then her bones adequately or respond and they come back to normal. And there's no evidence that women who have had a larger number of children than other women are at greater risk of a fracture in their elderly years than the younger women. So we assume from those sort of data that the mother's body completely re-establishes itself after that period of time. Now, when women go through the menopause, that's an entirely different question. That during the menopause, women lose their estrogen status, and therefore their estrogen levels drop markedly. Estrogen plays a role of consolidating calcium in the bone throughout life. It enhances the ability of the body to absorb calcium from the diet, as well it enhances the body to be able to maintain and conserve the calcium. And so when women lose their estrogen status at the menopause, there is a great leak of calcium out of the body and a slight drop in their ability to absorb calcium. And this calcium all has to come from the bone.
Do treatments like hormone replacement therapy help with this problem?
Hormone replacement therapy does have a remarkable effect on the bone and conserving calcium within the skeleton. The issue that has arisen with the use of hormone replacement therapy has been that there is a slight but significant increase in the risk of breast cancer. But the issue of using hormone replacement therapy to prevent fractures, particularly in the older years, such as around 80 or so, because has thought to be that the risk-benefit ratio is insufficient.
So what can older people do?
So first of all, if older people can use a nutritional strategy and lifestyle strategy to strengthen their bones, and so having an adequate vitamin D status and an adequate dietary calcium intake and regular exercise, that can assist in preventing the loss of bone, and actually what we've now just recently been showing can actually improve the quality of the bone. And it doesn't matter at what age that occurs, we believe our data suggests that even in the most elderly years, such a strategy can assist in. I would like to emphasise that experiencing fractures can be prevented. It is not a natural state of growing old, of ageing, which some of our medical colleagues might think, and certainly something that we used to think about in the past. It should be done, and something can be done with expert medical advice.
That's the program for today. Great to have you with us wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between Radio Adelaide, Sydney's 2SER, 4EB in Brisbane, and it's produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can hear it weekdays, same time on your local community radio station, and check us out on our website, thewire.org.au, where you can listen back to all of this that you heard here today. Visit us on Facebook, The Wire, Independent Current Affairs on Community Radio, and follow us on Twitter, The Wire Radio, all one word. Today's program came to you from our studios, 4EB in Brisbane. My name's Stephen McGall. We'll see you next time on The Wire.